Greetings, dear listeners. We recorded a live episode this week on Capitol Hill. Friend of the pod, Osidan Wanevu, wanted to have a discussion with Samuel Moyne about the courts, legitimacy, and democracy, so we pulled just that together. It ended up being a fascinating and far-ranging discussion, especially when the crowd got involved. I think you'll really enjoy this one. Before we get started, a reminder to head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and consider becoming a paying subscriber if you're not one yet. And don't forget to give us a like and a review on your favorite podcast app. With all that out of the way, on to the show. Thanks, everyone. Welcome. It's a real pleasure to be up here on stage with these two distinguished gentlemen. Quick introductions. Osita is he's a good friend. He's a close friend of our podcast, and he's working closely with Sam for the Philosophy and Society project at Aspen. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, columnist at The Guardian. He's got a new book out on democracy. Well, not out. It's at the printers, I think.
Not even at the printers. Very close. Soon to be at the printers.
So keep an eye out for that. And maybe most relevant to this conversation, he published a piece that has been endlessly provocative to me in any case in 2020 at The New Republic called The Constitution is the Crisis. Next to him is Sam Moyne. Who perhaps also doesn't need that much of an introduction to this group here. He's also a very prolific author whose concerns both dovetail and I think maybe at times diverge from Osita's. We'll see tonight. He's the Chancellor Kent Professor of Law and History at Yale Law School, and he's the author most recently of Liberalism Against Itself, Cold War Intellectuals and the Making of Our Times. Hopefully, yeah, we'll get to discuss some of the themes that are in that book. So, you know, Sam Kimbrell mentioned, you know, disagreement and debate. I don't think this will be a debate so much as a conversation. Like I said earlier, it's to be seen what the divergences are between our friends on stage here. I tend to think of both of them as the most thoughtful revolutionary thinkers on the left. Even though, with Osita's face, I don't think they'd consider themselves revolutionaries at all. But you know, let's just sort of kick this off maybe with a question to you, Sam, and let's just see where we end up. Basically, you recently have been arguing that the Supreme Court was right to... to not throw Trump off the ballot in the, what was it, the Anderson case. And your argument was that democratic legitimacy was at stake, more or less, I think. I mean, you can address that as you will. And yet, I think, you know, people who are familiar with your work also, I think, associate you with arguing that liberals and progressives oughtn't have too much deference for courts. Is there a tension there in your argument, would you say, like between this question of democratic legitimacy and that the courts are preserving and then like deference to the courts?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. I hope there's no tension. You know, I had a lot of reasons. I wrote about Trump versus Anderson before oral argument, let alone before it was decided. And I thought that the Supreme Court should do what it did. But consider that it had basically three options. It could let Colorado disqualify Donald Trump. It could disqualify Donald Trump itself. Or it could let him stay on the ballot nationally and, in a sense, let the people decide whether to, in effect, disqualify Donald Trump on their own through electoral politics. And so of those three options, of course, the court's involved in every one. There's a court decision. But the last was the least worst because it punted and it made the decision a majoritarian decision. It's just that, you know, we don't really have national majority elections yet. But I think the court did recognize that we, in a sense, have moved to a democracy, at least part way, in which presidents are elected nationally, and that's what's going to happen.
Mm. I mean, Osita, tell me, what's your exact disagreement? I mean, did you think the court acted correctly, or it should have, you know, taken Trump off the ballot? I mean, to preserve democracy, I mean, I guess is the counterargument to it.
Yeah, I mean, the specific legal ins and outs of the Anderson case were not especially interesting to me. I have to say, I'm not a lawyer. I was more interested in the normative question that I think that Sam has talked about so often and so eloquently, which is, let's assume for the sake of argument that there would have been a solid legal case to take Trump off of the ballot. Would there have been something anti-democratic or sort of normatively problematic with that decision, if all of the ducks had been in a row and that dots, I's had been dotted and T's been crossed? Would there have been something wrong with disqualifying Trump on that basis in that case? I don't think so. And I've sort of, you know, this is sort of the one of the few disagreements I think that Sam and I actually have. I don't know how this got billed as a debate. And the copy for this event that I helped draft, actually, the word debate does not appear, to my knowledge. And it doesn't appear because I think that Sam and I agree on basically like 80-ish% of things. And then the remaining 20% of things that have some relevance to this discussion, there's this narrow question about Trump that I think there's a sharp but narrow disagreement about. And then like a set of things that we'll talk about later that I have kind of questions about philosophically. But on the Trump point, I think that Sam sort of got to the heart of what I find troubling here in his piece that he wrote, I think, well before the decision actually happened for the New York Times in December of 2023, called The Supreme Court Should Overturn the Colorado Ruling Unanimously. So Sam writes, keeping Mr. Trump off the ballot could put democracy at more risk rather than less. Part of the danger lies in the fact that what actually happened on January 6th, and especially Mr. Trump's exact role beyond months of election denial and entreaties to government officials to side with him, is still too broadly contested. The Colorado court deferred to a lower court in the facts, but it was a bench trial, meaning that no jury ever assessed what happened and that many Americans still believe Mr. Trump did nothing wrong. Again, I think that there are plausible legal arguments he could have marshaled in Trump's defense in that case. But this last sentence, the idea that there is something important about the fact that many Americans believe Trump didn't do anything wrong, and the idea that that should have some kind of bearing on what the court should do, that does trouble me for a number of reasons. One, I think that many Americans believe is not really a sound basis for adjudicating a question of law, partially because many Americans can be wrong about things as a factual matter. And if we want to have... You want to have courts treat people fairly, I think that you can have these interpretive differences, but they should, I think, rest on some kind of basic level of fact. Number two, people have prejudices and biases. If we should be worried about investing too much power and authority in the court for that reason, I think Sam's right to write about that. We should also take seriously the fact that people are also not neutral, and the legislatures they elect are not necessarily neutral, and all of that should sort of factor into whether or not we advantage the court or democratic action in one case or another. Specific to this particular case, though, the third reason is that most Americans actually do not believe Trump did nothing wrong on January 6th. Most Americans do believe he bears some responsibility. The Washington Post put out a poll in January with some recent numbers. 53% of Americans believe Trump bears a great deal or a good amount of responsibility for January 6th. Out of those who believe he bore at least some responsibility, you get 71%. The portion of Americans he believes he had a great deal of responsibility alone is 38%, and more than the people who believe he didn't have responsibility. On the question of whether Trump is guilty of a criminal effort to overturn the 2020 election, 56% of Americans said he definitely or probably is. On the question of disqualification, they got a 46% plurality. ABC found a 56% majority for either disqualifying Trump totally or letting states like Colorado do it. Politico got a 51% majority on the same question in September. If you do believe that courts do have some kind of responsibility to democracy in the sense that they should weigh public opinion in some respect, I don't actually see why the minority opinion is the opinion that they should be weighing when I think a clear and durable majority of Americans do believe he did something wrong and would be happy to see him prosecuted. And the fourth thing, and I think this gets to the reason why we are so interested in this minority. The fourth thing that I think is relevant here is that people are afraid of this minority because they have guns. That's it. That is the reason why we are privileging them more than we would privilege any other minority in a controversial legal case. That's why we're privileging them over the majority of Americans. People are scared that if something happens to Trump, whether it's disqualification, whether it's prosecution, this Manhattan case, or other cases that are facing him, there's going to be some kind of conflagration. And I think implicitly the idea is that if we can forestall anything actually happening to Trump and holding him legally accountable for this or that, we can sort of forestall all of the morass and violence that might come out as a consequence of him being prosecuted. I don't think that is a good way to run a state. I don't think that's a good way to think about the law. I think that there are ways in which we might believe that we're doing something stabilizing in accounting for those kinds of contingencies when we make legal decisions or look to the courts for those kinds of decisions. But I think that that kind of contingency actually erodes the law. It undermines trust. It creates complexities and contradictions. And it ultimately, I think that you get to a place where we are less stable, less capable of making sense of the world if we sort of make these decisions on the basis of who gets the angriest and who's most willing to use violence.
Man, I think so this is a debate after all, no?
With maybe.
Yeah, maybe with me. But I mean, Sam, I'll let you jump in on any part of you that you want. But I mean, maybe just talk a little bit about, to me, what's striking about what Osita just said is where's the law in relation to popular will? What's the relationship there? And talk a little bit about legitimacy. Those seem to me like the big holes that I would drive a truck through on what Osita said right there. I don't know. But Sam, you take it.
Well, I think, you know, you have to distinguish between two different kinds of situations. One is a situation in which the law is clear. And then there's a situation in which it's not. And the disqualification case, like the immunity case that was argued at the Supreme Court the other day, both of those fall in the second category. And so the real question, because we can't just bracket whether the law is clear, is who decides? And the question is, should it be a majority of the American people or a majority of the judges? Now, the trouble is we don't have a presidential election system that actually always honors a majority of the American people, but at least there's a chance of having a debate among citizens about the future of the country. With judges, I think we only at best have an indirect chance to have them reflect their understanding of popular opinion based on, you know, their favorite polls. And so I actually don't disagree a lot with Osita. I wouldn't want to rest much of the case on the threat of violence. I'd rather suggest that, you know, if there's a credible reason to think that Trump will definitely win in November and he will credibly do terrible things, then we should maybe avoid that outcome by any means necessary. What I thought in December is that that's not the reality we have right now. There are many months between now and November. Biden's unfortunately had a lot of chances to make unforced errors. But the trouble is that Trump might have the support of a majority of our fellow citizens or enough of a minority to prevail in our undemocratic system, notwithstanding the fact you report, which they think he did some bad things on January 6th. You know, there's an argument that came out of West Germany, although maybe you think it's reflected in the 14th Amendment already after the Civil War, that democracies have to protect themselves against those who will scuttle them. And the trouble with that argument is that either the threat is minor enough that, you know, there's no reason to control it because not enough people support the, you know, threatening candidate or party, or the threatening candidate or party is popular enough that having a court dispose of it will lead to unpredictable consequences. That could include violence, but it could also include a sense that the system lacks a fundamental legitimacy. And so those are the reasons I would, you know, think that maybe on that 20%, I stick to my guns, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, Osita, tell me a little bit about, like, I was struck by what you're saying, though, right? Like, situate the rule of law for me then, right? I mean, you're at one level, you're saying majorities can be fickle and bigoted and biased, and, you know, so you can't trust them. At the same time, you wanted somehow judges to defer to polls about Trump's culpability on this.
I don't want them to defer the polls. I'm saying that if you're using public opinion as a justification for why judges should be careful, it matters what public opinion actually is.
Right.
And the preponderance of public opinion is that it is okay to prosecute.
But you
Trump.
Don't believe that. But where is the rule of law?
I don't think that, I'm only saying that because I think Sam has invested a good amount of weight in the idea that this is, or the disqualification would have been troubling, as you said just now, because there are so many Americans who would reject the decision, who would be angry about the decision, who would think that the decision was illegitimate. If you're appealing to public opinion, I think it matters what most Americans actually believe. I'm not somebody who thinks that the law should necessarily, determined by, or the interpretation of the law should necessarily depend on what polls happen to say in a given moment. But if you are appealing to the fact that many Americans would hate this decision, you should also take into account the fact that most Americans would be fine with it.
But when it comes to who's going to rule, don't we ask the people in an election rather than a poll?
We could, but
that's
the decisive question.
That's how we resolve disagreement in a democracy. It's not a democracy of polling, but of voting.
But I also think that in a democracy, it is entirely justifiable to have certain requirements, qualifications, standards that you have to meet as a candidate in order to contest office. Many of those people don't really have a problem with at all. If you are 34 years old in this country, you cannot run for the presidency, no matter how smart you are. No matter, you might be a professor or somebody on the way to be a professor at Yale Law School, you can't do it. If you were not born in this country, you cannot run for the presidency because you were not naturalized.
But those are arbitrary but codified, right?
Right. So I'm saying that if those are justifiable to people and people don't have problems with those and people think that those are normal, fine, sufficient restrictions that still preserve a kind of democratic electorate. Okay. To say that you are not allowed to contest office if you have previously tried to subvert the democratic process and overthrow the government does not seem to me like an inordinately draconian restriction on democratic participation. If I was going to choose one thing in an ideal society to have as the rule for contesting office, that would be the one thing that I would choose.
But the main problem is what Sam was saying, right? That the fact is that as a matter of law, it's not settled. It's not codified like the other things are. So at that point, the question is, it's just getting at that question of legitimacy and what I assume the justices are doing at times, even right now with the crazy immunity stuff I guess that's the core question is what is legitimacy and how do we talk about it? I mean, I feel like I agree with Sam. I have like a more intuitive sense of or a sense of agreement with Sam about like what constitutes legitimacy. And I've always actually had a difficult sense of figuring out what constitutes legitimacy for you, Osita. But I don't know, Sam, any thoughts?
I would say a couple of things. So remember that most constitutional law is actually rulemaking. And that's essentially what Osita is asking for. In the absence of a clear rule that might be a good idea, he was asking the judges or enough of them to do us all a solid by providing the rule that we never have provided ourselves. But then I don't want to get too edgy. I actually disagree with having such rules. Not just in cases when they're unclear, but I can think of a lot of situations in which I would like to vote for a 34-year-old or a foreigner, and I don't care that some dead man wrote on paper that that's not allowed. If enough people think in a particular moment, thinking of not the past but the future, that we ought to go one way, why should we let a clear rule forbid it? No reason I can think of, unless you just think we should, you know, live in the cage the Constitution built, which I thought you were against.
No, no. I think that we could have an instrumental relation to the Constitution on certain questions. There are certain things that I think we can turn to it for. And I think overall, we should move towards getting rid of it at a certain point. I think it's a 100-year project. But I think that the interim, we're faced with questions of power. And we're faced with the question of how we preserve democracy from moment to moment. And, you know, I guess to sort of bring this out of this specific situation, I do want to sort of think about a hypothetical. So if there was like a hard and clear rule, let's say that Trump had violated and it had been found and it was clear, it was obvious that he had clearly acted to overturn the election in 2020 as an insurrectionist. And yet many Americans still believed that he should run again. If the law had been more clear, would you have been more willing to say he should be stricken from the ballot?
Sure. Situation? I mean, the Supreme Court's institutional role, I don't agree with it, but everyone else thinks, and certainly the justices think, that they're there to interpret and enforce the rules. And to the extent there's a clear rule, maybe we think that those rules ought to be enforced. Now, I still think there's a question, because you can imagine an emergency in which, notwithstanding a clear rule, like I want AOC to be president before she was eligible.
Right.
And if the Supreme Court says she can't, well, maybe there's enough of us in a unique historical circumstance who think, well, she ought to get the job anyway.
But that's still privileging the court and its institutions and the institution of the Constitution over a democratic will
it's,
in that circumstance.
It's saying if we're talking about what the court should and is likely to do, of course it's got its institutional ethos. That doesn't mean I think it ought to be there, but I haven't won that battle yet.
So, I mean, both of you have this idea of, you know, winning that battle against the constitutional order. That's why I called you both revolutionaries. I mean,
it's a modest reform.
Sure. Modest reforms. A modest proposal. Right. But I do want to sort of poke at that. Sam, you're reading you, like, tell me if this is correct. You would not be opposed, or maybe you would most like that we had something like the English system of actually that the rule of law is purely acts of Parliament, that there is no judicial review of those things. Parliament is sovereign. That is, representative body is sovereign. There's no contesting that. I mean, that's what's striking about it, right? Like the whole English Bill of Rights is an act of Parliament. That's where the rights come from. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
And actually, if you look at American history, most rights have come from statute.
Right.
And if we look over the broad expanse of the history of the Supreme Court, it's been inimical to rights. You know, great example would be the civil rights cases of 1883, in which the Supreme Court invalidated a civil rights law for African Americans and colluded in getting rid of Reconstruction energy. And then in our time, when the Congress finally got around to passing another rights bill, the Voting Rights Act, the Supreme Court in Shelby County v. Holder shredded it. So I'm not seeing why we need the Council of Elders to save us from democracy. We need democracy.
Osita, I mean, do you subscribe to Sam's sort of view about like that kind of sovereign acts of democracy, or do you ascribe to, again, some concept of transcendent rights? Maybe Sam, you do too, and maybe I'm just not being fair to that. Is there such a thing as a transcendent right, or is it just something that a group of people say, these are rights, this is what they are, we define them, you protect them? Do they exist outside? Either of you, I don't know.
I believe in rights.
But how? Yeah.
Look, on this question, I think that again, you know, there's so much about what Sam has written over the last several years. I think the first thing I read on this sort of realm was this piece he did for Boston Review about juristocracy. I can't remember what it was called specifically.
Resist the Juristocracy.
Resist the Juristocracy. where he lays out, I think very compellingly, this idea that I think a lot of liberals have adopted over the last 50, 60 years or so, that the courts and the Supreme Court are places we should turn to for the protection of rights, the expansion of rights, partially as a consequence of the Warren Court and all of these sort of civil rights cases, and you know, just had the Obergefell thing, et cetera, et cetera. That is a kind of very narrow understanding of the Supreme Court's history, that for most of the Supreme Court's history, as Sam just said, it's been a reactionary force. It's actually constrained rights. And also, I think even the more compelling thing actually to me is this idea that courts in and of themselves, outside of any kind of specific political context, are conservative institutions. When you want to bring a case, people who prevail in those kinds of cases are people with a lot of time, a lot of money. And that is intrinsically going to advantage certain people and disadvantage other people. And so in that sense, the court in general is not going to be something you can rely upon for progressive change or necessarily to defend progressive rights. I take all of that very seriously.
Also conservative just because they're defending like an existing set. I mean, right, by definition, right? They're interpreting, therefore conservative, right?
Yeah. For that reason too. So I take all of that seriously. But I do have this sort of question about the ideal world that we want to go to. So that shining moment in 2573 or whatever, when we've gotten rid of the Constitution, and we have a new order, and we've set up a new government, what is the role of courts there? This is a society, obviously, we've dealt with, you know, we've dealt with a lot of the structural inequities, blah, 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 blah. But in that kind of ideal system, what actual role do we think courts would ideally play, and why? Is a question that I've actually sort of a lot with, because I do have this kind of like itching liberal that I have not yet killed in my brain, who does sort of think about this question of fundamental rights. So in a system in which all of the rights we have are derived from statutes, and you have a majority of people, I mean, this is like a basic question. Like, you have a majority of people that wants to disenfranchise a minority of people, or wants to curtail the freedom to worship for certain people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What happens then as a practical matter if we care about human agency and freedom and dignity? And is it actually so troubling to imagine that there are a set of transcendent rights that we value and we think we should protect and we should insulate at least a little bit? I think the tension there is the courts are the place where we've staple liberalism to democracy in many respects, right? And so when somebody does, when the majority is, you know, wants to disenfranchise or enslave minority or something, the idea is that you have courts say, no. Look, people have rights. People have intrinsic dignity. You wrote it all down. Here it is. And you can't do that. And that sounds nice and that sounds lovely, but it raises all of these questions that Sam has put forward, which is that when you do that, in that particular case, it sounds great, but you've actually privileged in some fundamental way a set of values and a set of particular institutions over democracy. What do we do with that? I've been influenced on this question by somebody named Corey Bretschneider at Brown University. He wrote a book in 2007 called Democratic Rights, where he says, look, a lot of the things that we consider liberal rights, we actually have the resources to explain and justify within democracy. If we care about democracy because it is a system of values that grants people agency and the amount and sort of control on the basis of their own equality and dignity over the conditions that shape their lives, there are certain things that system of values or that set of values alone disqualifies without fundamentally eroding or undermining democracy as a matter of political philosophy, theory, whatever we want to call it. There are things that democracies can do that can be self-negating and impermissible because they hit at and destroy some of the fundamental concepts that make us value democracy in the first place. I find that very compelling, but it doesn't solve this question, actually. As a practical matter, majority of people want to do something. You want them not to be able to do that specific thing. You create the set of institutions that can block that specific thing, but they also do all kinds of other things that we don't like. I don't have an answer, but I am more, I guess I'll just bite the bullet in the sense that I do think that there are certain things that we are entitled to as human beings, a certain fundamental dignity that all of us have, that I do place actually higher than democratic outcomes. In fact, the reason why I value democracy is that I think that democracy at its best will get us to an enhancement and protection of those things. It's kind of like an instrumental pace. I think that there's a way democracy contributes to human flourishing that, you know, builds us up as liberal individuals, I guess.
I mean, it's the question.
So if that makes me merely an ultra Democrat and not a super duper ultra mega whatever balls of the wall Democrat, I'm willing to say, yeah, it's fine.
But so, I mean, I guess the way out of it, Sam, is a belief in moral progress, that like this instrumental nature of democracy leads to the education of a people to value these things more over time. I think that's how you square that circle, right?
I think there's a lot to say at this point.
So, yeah, no, sure. I mean, take it wherever.
You know, first, I think that democracy is instrumental to other ends, which are legitimate, like justice. But it's also of intrinsic importance. Like, it matters that we rule ourselves. But the question is, who's going to enforce justice, whether that is, you know, takes the form of some account of rights. No serious thinker believes that there's just an obvious set of rights without conflicts that don't sometimes need to be overridden by other imperatives. And so always the question comes back to who's going to protect what's really important and who's going to make the call when there's disagreement about what's really important. And so there's never going to be a situation, I believe, at least from my understanding of history, in which it's just obvious what to do when the hateful majority turns against it. I mean, we haven't seen that, really. We have seen, you know, people fight tooth and nail not to have democracy, to serve their own advancement and ends. We haven't seen much democracy in the world so far. You agree, I think, that there's for a long time going to be a lot of overlap between the campaign for self-rule and, you know, our own view of justice, whatever it might be. There are going to be conflicts and there are going to be times when democracy leads the wrong way. But my question is, why would you think that there's some person or group of people, the Council of Elders, that can rule in our stead when we're making mistakes, knowing that there are mistakes in the first place when there's disagreement about it?
Can I just jump on one thing you said? There's not much democracy in the world. Where's Britain on that, for example? I mean, I keep sort of coming back to that, not because it's a perfect democracy, but it's more democratic in some ways, I think, that correspond to your critique, right? And to me, the glaring example for it is Brexit, right? And these are not rights that were trampled. This was a set of values and policy preferences that were trampled by a majority, leading to a disgruntled minority that's now likely to get power again. And, you know, was going to try and somehow figure that out. But again, you know, you were saying just now there's not much democracy out there, but there is, right? I mean, or we're talking about some level of democracy.
Compared to human history, you know, over millennia, there's surely been some big changes in the last couple hundred years, right? But it might be early days. Mm-hmm. Now, I agree that democracy then places a lot of burden on us if we think we've reached the right policies through our laws to maintain support for them and not allow our politics to be captured by elites who mismanage for their own ends. Because 2016 was really a protest vote across the Atlantic on elite failure. And, you know, I think it was justified that there was a protest and there is a continuing protest. And, you know, the attempts to dodge it with which we began this conversation, I think are short sighted. They're understandable, but you're not going to get into the clear until you have durable majority support for what you care about. That's the coin of the realm, even in our foreshortened democracy. And, you know, I then agree with Jane Addams, who said, you know, the cure for the ills of democracy is more democracy, not some idealized set of judges who will save us from the problems, including the disasters that can occur.
Right.
I mean, demagoguery, is that something you worry about? I mean, sure, we're all against it on some level, but it's a thing, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
That's why I'm against it.
It's comparative risk. We're all against a lot of things. And the question is, who's mistreated by elite rule, including elites on the Supreme Court, who are, again, the most business-friendly Supreme Court, including the liberals we've had since the first Gilded Age. Right. So that kind of thing is bad, too. And demagoguery is like a predictable outcome of this kind of elite misrule. So then we have to figure out who's at risk from whom and which risks are worse and how do we get out of the risk?
Yeah. You know, again, like there's substantial agreement here. First of all, I definitely do not believe that there is any kind of legal avenue to solving the problem that Donald Trump poses as a political figure. You can put him in jail or whatever, but you will not have solved or fundamentally addressed the things that brought him to power in the first place. I think that is true. Back when I supported impeachment strongly, it wasn't so much because I believed that he was going to be successfully prosecuted by Congress or found guilty by Congress, but because I thought that that would be a stage upon which the Democratic Party would have the opportunity to make a case, not only against him, but against the Republican Party as a whole. It would be a political venue, because impeachment is a political process. But the idea that I think a lot of people do have still, that there's going to be one day when you're going to see the cuff slammed on this guy and he's going to be carted away and we'll enter into the sunshine of a new era in politics, whatever. That's not going to happen. So I agree with Sam on that. That's not why I think that that's not why I think he's worth prosecuting. I just think that people, when they commit crimes, should whatever. But I also wanted to say too that on the Council of Elders thing, you know, again, like there's no conception of an ideal democratic state, for me at least, that has a judiciary system that looks anything like the present American judiciary system, where people are offering to donate their organs to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Like, it's not something I want to replicate. It's not something I want to return to. I think that much of what is valuable in Sam's work is demonstrating all the different alternatives for how the courts can interact with other institutions in government on some of these interpretive questions. It should not be the court's responsibility alone to interpret the law. The legislature has a role there. The executive branches and agencies have roles there. I think that ideas like jurisdiction stripping, where you say when you pass a law that certain elements of it aren't going to be subject to court interpretation or revocation, I think that's worth looking at. You just published something in dissent that I thought was very provocative and interesting about all the ways in which we already right now have other places in government reject court rulings as a matter of course. It doesn't have to be this kind of radical worst case scenario. There are places where that's actually kind of routine, or at least not so uncommon. So to my mind, when I'm thinking about the democracy that I would like to see, the fuzziest area is the judiciary. I don't know what the right answer is, but I do think that we have a wealth of resources to draw upon, including the experience of other countries. I mean, I think the Netherlands doesn't have judicial review at all, if I'm not mistaken. There are other models we can look at for how judiciaries can work, other ways the courts work in other countries. And I think we could draw upon that to develop something better. I'm just sort of wrestling still with this kind of fundamental brass tacks question of, at those moments where democracy falters and doesn't deliver the things that we would want to deliver to the people who are most vulnerable in society, etc. Obviously, we cannot necessarily trust the courts as we've known them, but is there a role for courts in a different system, in a different society, in a different construction? I'm still working through that question.
Well, so we're going to open it up for questions in a second. Let me just ask one more to maybe prime the pump here, which I think will maybe tie a bow on current events and hopefully antagonize a lot of you out there to ask more questions. But the question then comes back to Trump and immunity. You know, the core problem is this question of sovereignty and the rule of law. In our system, we have the executive. I do think Trump's arguments are, and again, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not following that closely. I do think they're pretty spurious, but as you said, Sam, these are not open and shut questions, right? There's a real problem here. I mean, I think one of my colleagues at the Post wrote this, Jason Willick, I think. If he hasn't written it, he should. He said something along the lines of, the real problem of Donald Trump is he's making us confront these edge cases in our system that we just shouldn't be fucking touching, because it's really goddamn hard to sort this. So Talk a little bit to me about that, about, you know, the edge of the rule of law, the problem of sovereignty, and then, you know, the courts in this, like, I don't know.
So just real quick, I think, unfair to the Supreme Court in calling it a council of elders, because, of course, that's our Senate. Like, literally, the name is council of elders, Senate, senile, Mitch McConnell, Dianne Feinstein. But there is this legitimate question about what role courts should play. And in a constitutional system, even more, it's even more, you know, important to think about. You know, on immunity, you know, we have one ruling, Nixon versus Fitzgerald, which says, you know, past presidents are immune from civil suit. A lot of people think that on general principle, sitting presidents should be immune from criminal prosecution. So then it's not that far a step to say that past presidents should be immune from criminal prosecution for basically the same reasons as those other immunities were hewed out. Now, none of it's in the Constitution. So if you have an old Constitution that's unamendable, you are going to have judicial policymaking in the name of the Constitution. And that's how we have those other immunities. So we've set ourselves up for this, asking the nine people, men and women now, what they think. And it's a pure policy question. And if you don't like their answer, either you're just taking a partisan side, or you have the view that someone else should make policy in a democracy. That's my view. And it's true. Trump has, in really interesting ways, reminded us what we should already know, that the Constitution just doesn't tell us what to do in so many instances. The law doesn't either. Ordinary statutory law. That's why I think OCEDA's on the right track, that we need to think really hard about thinking about the law as policymaking, including when judges interpret it. You know, West Virginia versus EPA gutting the, you know, our environmental law. Who should make those decisions, which aren't even constitutional? And that's why I hope we're at the beginning of a period where we say the courts are there to implement the people's law. But when there are doubts about their interpretation of it, at least of a sufficient magnitude, we should have mechanisms for throwing the decision back to a more legitimate authority. And if Donald Trump began to get us to think about that eventuality, you know,
there's something to
maybe
like.
Maybe he emerges as a hero as soon as we vote him down.
OCEDA, any other thoughts before we open it up?
No.
No.
That's it for part one, dear listeners. There's a lot more where that came from. If you're not yet a paying subscriber, please head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and become one. Help support our work. Hope to see you in the bonus.